You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We are a global NGO with research experts in more than 20 countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. Our second series is hosted by Elizabeth Dykstra McCarthy, a former member of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre Natural Resources team, who is now consulting on climate action and environmental issues around the world. Along with several special guests, she'll delve into the social impact of the transition minerals boom, the pitfalls of futuristic methods of mineral extraction, and the capacity of communities to hold companies accountable for abuse, all in search of answers to the question, what is the true cost of clean energy?
The climate crisis is upon us. With it comes the urgent need to decarbonize and transform our economies from those reliant on fossil fuels to greener, cleaner sources of energy. Governments and companies around the world and droves of concerned citizens are driving this transition forward for the good of the planet, its people, and its creatures. But not all people will benefit equally. As the renewable energy transition accelerates, what will the challenges be? Who might the hidden victims be? And what can we do now to make this transition as just as possible?
Hydropower is woven in the very fabric of our nation. It is our largest source of renewable energy, provides the backbone of our electric system.
The Liangkekou Dam is located at the convergence of three rivers, the Yalong, the Shanshui, and the Qingda, in southwestern Sichuan province. It's just the latest mega dam in China, and authorities hope it will help the country meet its ambitious climate and renewable energy targets of reaching carbon neutrality by 2060.
When we talk about the largest hydropower project in the world, people often cite China's Three Gorges Dam, but a much older dam has recently been producing more electricity. This monster dam is the Itaipu Dam on the River Paraná, bordering Brazil and Paraguay.
On the waters of Rufiji River, 370 kilometers southwest of the commercial capital Dar es Salaam, the dream is coming true. With a 2,115-megawatt installed capacity hydropower dam in the Morogoro region. Julius Nyerere Hydropower Project.
From electrification to renewable energy implementation, all the way down the supply chain, there are no silver bullets. Whilst the sentiment rises amongst citizens worldwide that governments and corporations should take every action necessary to respond to the climate crisis, it isn't always clear what every action necessary might consist of. Every action and every initiative has a cost. The question is, what cost and to whom? Too often, that cost has been borne by the poorest and most marginalized of any given society. The benefits are reaped elsewhere. In the renewable energy field, nowhere is this more evident than in hydropower projects. Today, we'll be exploring how an energy source which has been at the vanguard of the renewable energy movement has come with considerable costs, and where it can go from here.
Well, historically, hydropower has been the dominant form of renewable energy, as most of our renewable energy has come from hydropower over time. And only recently, as solar PV, wind, and bioenergy have been developed, have they gained attention within the renewable energy sector.
We're kicking off with Dr. Noah Kittner, a professor at the University of North Carolina, where he has focused on the relationship between low-carbon development and energy systems, particularly in Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar. In the last 25 years, hydropower generation has more than doubled in size. It represents now 17% of the global energy mix, the most dominant by far of all the renewable energies. In fact, as of this year, hydropower generation made up almost 60% of the entire world's renewable energy supply. To contrast, whilst they are the fastest growing sectors, wind and solar make up a mere 21% and 11% respectively. This is likely to shift naturally as wind and solar expand at their current rates and the number of viable hydropower projects slowly decreases.
That kind of speaks to the amount of hydropower that has been used, as it's been more competitive with thermal power generation than solar and wind, even though there has been a lot more excitement recently about advances in solar and wind technology, perhaps.
Hydropower does have some major advantages, not least of which is solving the challenge of intermittency.
The idea is that the sun doesn't shine at night, and sometimes the wind doesn't blow, but oftentimes water or hydropower can kind of fill in the gaps of when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow in a way that you could imagine thermal power generation like natural gas or coal could be turned on and off. So because water can be controlled in hydropower systems through storing water in a reservoir, it has often been linked as a way to balance out the intermittency of wind and solar.
Costa Rica ran on 100% renewable energy for 337 days, 11 months in 2020.
Now the country has fully renewable energy, thanks to hydropower's on-demand flexibility and storage services, adding grid resilience.
Ser emisiones netas cero en el 2050 es una meta muy ambiciosa, pero las condiciones las tenemos.
This year, Costa Rica was able to produce 100% of its energy from renewable energy sources. Two-thirds of this come from hydropower.
And another example is like Albania, where about more than 90% of its electricity is all from hydropower. So that country has almost exclusively relied on hydropower for electricity. There are other examples, as you mentioned, like Costa Rica, that are looking into developing clean energy plans without combustion energy sources. And that's where I think hydropower has played a role.
A significant role. Such a monumental success wouldn't have been possible with today's technology, given the past trajectory of investment and implementation of renewables.
Not to say that solar and wind are the only options, or even just that hydropower is necessary, but it has played a really large role in terms of meeting that intermittency challenge of solar and wind, and also providing a traditional baseload form of electricity that could be pretty reliable and generally provide large bulk amounts of power for a long time.
Let's pause here, because the term baseload will crop up again. And it's pretty fundamental to understanding the advantage of hydropower.
Baseload power has referred to 24/7 generation of power from a power plant. So the idea that you could rely on a steady source of electricity generation without interruption for a long period of time. This has been the traditional form of power systems planning, but now as more intermittent energy sources have been available, such as solar electricity or wind, people are thinking about how much base load is really needed to accommodate new sources that are somewhat variable.
And how does this relate to hydropower?
And I should mention that not all hydropower is base load. Some of the larger systems could be classified as base load because they have such a large reservoir of water that you could effectively generate a steady amount of power for a very long duration and not really have many issues. But there are smaller scales of hydropower, ones in the kilowatt to just several megawatt scales that may not have a large reservoir. They may be based more run of river, and so their generation may be tied more to the water flow in the river and therefore could be more of a variable source of electricity.
Hold that thought, because we'll be coming back to the difference between large-scale hydropower and smaller-scale run-of-the-river hydropower later in the episode. Large-scale dams can come with devastating costs, and particularly for the communities that previously relied on that river resource. Perhaps one of the most controversial dam projects was the Three Gorges Dam in the Yangtze River in China. At the time, it was the biggest hydropower dam in the world, at 22,500 megawatts of electricity, and the creation of it required the flooding of the Kutang, Wu and Shiling gorges for some 600 kilometers upstream. The controversy surrounding the impacts of this immense deep water reservoir, the displacement of somewhere between 1 to 2 million people in over 1,500 cities, towns and villages along the river, and the destruction of cultural heritages. It was estimated that the dam would flood 1,283 archaeological sites.
It is quite simply the largest, most expensive, most powerful, and arguably the most controversial dam in all of history. Today, we take you to China, to the Three Gorges Dam. It's 10 years now since the massive project was completed. Imagine this 185 meters high. That's the equivalent of a building of more than 60 floors. And it is 2 kilometers long. The reservoir behind it.
The obligatory relocation of 1.2 million people has given rise to a lot of criticism in the past.
On the Yalong River, this Buddhist monastery will be affected as well.
It's also led to huge changes for the Yangtze River's biodiversity. The world's third biggest river is now all but devoid of fish.
It's also had an environmental toll, triggering landslides and harming biodiversity. China's roughly 24,000 dams have allowed it to become the world's largest producer of hydropower, accounting for some 18%.
Even the projects that don't go ahead have their own consequences. In Honduras, an indigenous rights activist, Berta Cáceres, who had previously been awarded a Green Nobel Prize for her work in campaigning against a hydropower project planned for the Gualcarque River, was murdered in her home.
In more than 150 indigenous assemblies, our community decided that it did not want that hydroelectric dam.
Berta filed complaints with the Honduran government and organized peaceful protests in the nation's capital. As her visibility increased, she became a target for the government.
The Business and Human Rights Resource Center has tracked attacks against environmental defenders, of which a significant proportion were resisting hydropower plants. What makes this all the more galling is that often these hydropower plants are developed with the claims that they will alleviate poverty and, in particular, tackle energy poverty.
I don't think that explicitly you can really link some of these large-scale hydropower dams to economic growth or even some of the poverty alleviation claims that have been made. And you can see that in a shift in thinking from international financial institutions such as the World Bank, really phased out of investments in very large-scale hydropower dams for a lot of these concerns around safeguarding people's livelihoods and also just the general ecological impacts, and maybe with less of an anticipated impact on lifting people out of poverty.
Could you give an example of that?
In Myanmar, there was a free power, free share program where there was a series of hydropower dams that were built to electrify some villages that were adjacent to the plants in exchange for being able to build those dams there. And the benefits were really unevenly distributed. So most of that power was being exported to China or used by the military exclusively. And a lot of the people that did not receive the amount of access to electricity that would enable really electrification of their villages. Maybe they had some connections, but it didn't really provide the poverty alleviation benefits that were touted in the program.
As Noah describes, this isn't unusual for hydropower projects.
There is a big physical disconnect between where the impacts are felt and where, in terms of the negative local impacts and where the energy is actually used, because typically it's transmitted over very far distances to, say, an urban center that has an increased demand for electricity. What I've seen in work on the Mekong River is that there's a lot of increased demand for electricity for air conditioning and shopping malls in urban areas, such as in Bangkok. And some of the large-scale hydropower plants that have been installed have had really negative impacts and marginalized local communities in Laos and Cambodia and on the border of Thailand and Laos that depend on that river system for food.
In fact, this is exactly the example we're going to dive into later in the episode, the proposed building of a large-scale dam in the Mekong Delta. So sit tight for that. For this, it's important to remember this issue of inequity.
This has really impacted people in different ways. And really, it's lower-income individuals that have felt the most negative impacts, and typically because their diets are more tied toward fish protein. And not just the fish there, but also being able to produce rice or other crops that are really important requires some management of water. And if you're susceptible to unexpected flooding because there's not enough sediment to give you a hold of your land, then that your land could disappear before your eyes. And that's happening in some parts of southern Vietnam, further downstream. But because the sediment that would have traveled along the river is not settling in those areas, and it's getting trapped in some of the dams, that has a really big impact on people whose livelihoods depend on agriculture. So it's typically the people who are benefiting the most from the electricity are not living next to the rivers necessarily, and not really depending on the rivers as much as directly So it's sort of an out-of-sight, out-of-mind problem.
These are all undoubtedly devastating impacts on the communities surrounding these dams. However, the cost-benefits analysis here often seems to be that the cost, lost homes and livelihoods, damaged ecosystems and biospheres, is worth the benefit, which could be vast amounts of greenhouse gas-free energy. Even if, of course, it is easy to say that the cost is worth the benefit, when we might appreciate the benefits, but certainly don't feel the costs. Just think about the 22,500 megawatts of clean, reliable energy from the Three Gorges Dam. That was certainly the argument there. But there is another spanner in these works. What if it isn't just local social effects? What if the clean machine might not be so green?
Hydropower has just been considered universally low carbon, clean energy, renewable, on par with wind and solar. And in a lot of ways, that makes sense. We are not burning fossil fuels and emitting pollutants that are affecting our air quality and climate in the same way that we are with fossil fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. We don't have smokestacks. We don't have dirty systems with hydropower. So in some sense, it is very clean. However, because of the environment of a hydropower facility, usually relying on a reservoir, there are actually a lot of greenhouse gases that are emitted into the atmosphere, just in a completely different way than fossil fuels. And so this has been largely overlooked in the public discourse.
This is Dr. Elissa Ocko, a climate scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, who has been researching the implications of short-lived pollutants on climate change and the climate impacts of hydropower. Here, she's explaining that hydropower, rather than being a clean energy source, i.e. one that doesn't emit greenhouse gases, hydropower can be a considerable source of damage. But how? What about a reservoir creates those greenhouse gases?
So the majority of greenhouse gas emissions from hydropower facilities come from vegetation that is underwater, and it is decomposing as vegetation underwater does. And some of this vegetation is there just because when you flooded the landscape, you now are all of that vegetation and soil that once was not underwater is now underwater. And then sometimes you have more vegetation that is like algae that is growing in your reservoir that also decomposes and respires. And sometimes you just have more vegetation that's coming in from the river and is getting stuck in the reservoir. And so all of those different sources of vegetation into the reservoir, along with the soils, as they break down the organic matter that's in those materials, it emits carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere.
By now, we all know that the carbon dioxide present in the atmosphere is causing havoc, that it is the accumulation of carbon dioxide in our biosphere that is warming the planet. But methane, oft forgotten, plays a role as well.
Carbon dioxide and methane are the two most important greenhouse gases that control today's warming. They act very differently from each other. Carbon dioxide is fairly weakly absorbing as a molecule, but it can last for centuries in the atmosphere, so it builds up over time. And then methane is much more powerful at trapping heat for equal mass. It can trap more than 100 times as much heat than the same amount of CO2, but it only lasts for around a decade in the atmosphere. So it packs a powerful warming punch in a short period of time, but then it is quickly removed from the atmosphere. So basically, the reservoir is just serving as this source of deterioration of organic materials that is emitting CO2 and methane into the atmosphere. And totally depends on the reservoir, how much is being emitted. It is all over the place. And that is part of the challenge as well.
So it is the breakdown of this vegetation which causes the emission of carbon and methane. But what determines how much of those greenhouse gases are being sent up into the ether?
The size of the reservoir in terms of the surface area is really important for determining how much greenhouse gases are emitted. So it doesn't necessarily matter the volume. If you have a deeper but smaller surface area for your reservoir, you'll typically have less greenhouse gas emissions. So you can control that when you're designing new reservoirs. You basically want to not have a very expansive reservoir. And that also plays a role in terms of how much vegetation you're covering, how shallow parts of the reservoir are. You can have more bubbling of methane in shallower regions. You also can deplete oxygen in certain climates when the temperature is really warm. So there are different factors that you can control, but also the amount of energy that you generate from your reservoir is very important. And there, unfortunately, are a lot of plants that are very large, but don't generate a lot of electricity. And that is not very effective. And that means that compared to other energy sources, you're not having that strong of a climate benefit because you're emitting so much CO2 and methane, and you're not even generating that much electricity from it. If you are able to generate more and more electricity, even if you have a large surface area, it will be a net benefit for the climate compared to other energy sources like coal and natural gas. So it really depends on this ratio between the surface area of the reservoir and how much energy you are generating.
This is not an easy calculation exercise, and it isn't helped by the other confounding factors.
It also really matters what the landscape was emitting before the reservoir was there, which adds to the complication, because many of these systems were emitting greenhouse gases before. Many of them were sinks for greenhouse gases. So in order to know how your hydropower facility is affecting the climate, you kind of need to know what was happening before that facility ever existed, before that reservoir was flooded.
Other factors include where the plant is geographically and the local weather conditions, as well as local terrain.
Part of that is the climate being warmer. And, you know, when you have a warmer climate, you can have more methane emissions because you don't have vertical mixing of your water column, which means that less oxygen is transported to the bottom layer where this organic matter is decaying, which means that as the organic matter decays, it can't complete the oxidation chain to CO2, and it ends up stopping at methane and emitting methane. So that's part of the reason, but there are also just larger, shallower reservoirs in certain parts of the world versus some areas where you have a lot of mountains, for example. You can have deeper, narrower reservoirs that don't emit as much.
And of course, this all depends on how we measure.
The importance of time really matters here, because when you look at average hydropower greenhouse gas emissions, most people value the methane emissions over the following 100 years, which is really critical distinction and undervalues the importance of these methane emissions in the near term. And this has been completely overlooked in energy and policy conversations.
This is particularly critical as we think about these roadmaps to 2030, carbon neutral by 2050 kind of targets, which have been the focal point of 2021 as governments queue up to make their net zero by 2050 commitments.
Biden reiterated his commitment to the U.S.-Canada relationship and pledged to work together on achieving net zero emissions by 2050.
We also doubled down on our efforts to tackle climate change. It was really, really
one of the world's most criticized polluters. Australia has formally adopted a target of net zero carbon emissions by 2050, and it joins other countries around the world.
This world in a better condition than what we inherited. And that's why today we're announcing that we will be ending our contribution to climate change by 2050 and legislating for a net zero emissions
target. The world's biggest source of greenhouse gases, that's China, who pledged carbon neutrality by 2060.
Depending on how we calculate, those goals might be infinitely more or less achievable. Not to mention, the next 25 years have a greater importance than the following 25 because of how quickly the climate is warming. the effects that are getting baked into the system, and the potential tipping points which could come speeding towards us faster than we imagined.
There's a disconnect right now between how we evaluate climate impacts of actions and the policy-relevant timescales that we care about. So if we care about what the climate's going to be like in mid-century, in 2050, then we need to use timescales in our analyses that align with that timeline, because right now they're not aligned, and we're going to end up with a different climate outcome in the middle of the century than we anticipate, because we are just looking at over the next 100 years. Which, for example, what that means, if you can visualize it, is how we are valuing methane and its importance on the climate is we are taking a pulse emission, so emission of methane right now, and we are looking at its climate impact over the next 100 years. But it's really only in the atmosphere for the next 10 years. So the following 90 years, it's not in the atmosphere anymore, but we are accounting for that warming impact when it's not in the atmosphere. And we are comparing that to CO2's climate impact from a pulse emissions right now over the following 100 years. But the CO2 lasts the whole time. There's still 40% of the CO2 is still in the atmosphere 100 years from now. Your accounting is completely off, and you're undervaluing the importance of methane. So this is a really big problem. And the answer is not just using these shorter time horizons, because then the flip side of that is then you're undervaluing the importance of your CO2 in affecting climate stability in the long term. So you really need to have some sort of system where you look at the climate impacts over time, or you're looking at climate impacts in both the near term and the long term, so that you make sure you're not missing these impacts over the next 20, 30 years.
Yikes, that's a whole lot to take in, but it comes down to not having systems which are capable of accounting for the short-term and long-term impacts simultaneously, methane and carbon dioxide, in a way that can help us make informed policy decisions. Or rather, those balanced decision-making processes aren't being used.
And this is a really important insight from our paper, that when you value methane appropriately over time, you have a lot more climate impact in the first 5, 10, 20 years from your hydropower facility. And this is what can make it worse for the climate than some fossil fuel facilities in the near term.
The idea that hydropower could be more emissions intensive than fossil fuel plants is fairly alarming, given how widespread they are and how much they have contributed to our renewable energy quotients over the past few decades. So how much worse are they exactly?
When we compare the average hydropower facility based on our best available data of what greenhouse gas emissions are, the hydropower facilities can be 10 to 30 times worse for the climate than for the same unit of energy produced in the near term. When you compare it to solar, it still can be 5 to 10 times worse than solar in the near term. So it's certainly not on par with wind and solar. These are average conditions. Some plants are far better for the climate than these average conditions, which means they certainly can be on par with solar and wind. Some facilities are far worse than this, which means they can be a lot worse, not only than wind and solar, but even have higher climate impacts in the near term than fossil fuel sources. So on average, we see that hydropower facilities could have maybe up to 40% the climate impacts of the fossil fuel system. So overall, hydropower is much better, but it's certainly not climate neutral in a way that a lot of people think about it. And when we look at all the hydropower facilities worldwide, around 10% could be worse than fossil fuels in the near term.
This is a huge takeaway. If the greenhouse gas emissions from some hydropower facilities are worse than fossil fuels, combined with the ecological and social damage, it makes even less sense to be pursuing
them. But the bottom line from our paper is that you can't universally think that hydropower is clean. You need to look at specific facilities and how much energy is being generated and what kind of conditions are there that are leading to high greenhouse gas emissions, and then decide how beneficial this is for the climate relative to other alternatives. So there's no one size fits all here. It will be a case by case basis, and some facilities are potentially a lot more damaging than other ones. So we do not want to suggest whatsoever that hydropower is not good for the climate, but we can't just assume that it is.
And what might the consequences be of ignoring such a factor? Well, as governments worldwide map out their future trajectories, hydropower could be playing a significant role. Every year, the International Energy Agency puts out a projection for different energy mixes and scenarios which could play out, and their consequences.
Depending on any of these scenarios, you could increase the amount of electricity generation from hydropower by 45 to 70% relative to right now by 2040.
This could mean an enormous impact as hydropower scales up, which means it is the critical juncture to act. China added 12.6 gigawatts of hydropower capacity in 2020, its largest addition of the previous 5 years, and right behind it are Brazil, Turkey, and India. Decisions made now will be baked into our futures from both an emissions and a social perspective. So how can we incorporate this into policymaking?
How potentially good or bad this is for the climate really depends on where you're scaling up your hydropower and what the greenhouse gas emissions will be like from those hydropower facilities. So some things you can control, like the size of your reservoir and how much electricity you generate from the reservoir, which will make it better for the climate if we are replacing what would have been fossil fuels with the hydropower facilities. But if it's wind, solar, or hydropower, you're typically going to be better off with solar or wind in almost all cases. So you definitely want to electrify as much as possible and use solar and wind for your electricity where you can. There's less risks with that because of all of these characteristics of a reservoir that can lead to more greenhouse gases.
So that is step one. Incorporate greenhouse gas reductions into hydropower facility design now that we know where the dangers might lie.
And there are certain parts of the world, like India and Africa, where it could potentially be problematic if they're building new facilities that have greenhouse gas emissions similar to what some of their higher emitting facilities have. And so that could end up contributing more to warming than had they just relied on coal or natural gas instead of a new hydropower facility. And I think we need to be really careful and monitor what these greenhouse gas emissions are so that we don't end up with some sort of perverse outcome where we have good intentions but end up making a problem worse.
In fact, Africa has been slated as the continent with the largest untapped hydropower resources. About 92% of feasible potential has not yet been tapped. Projects have received funding from governments and multilateral banks from Sierra Leone to Madagascar, Equatorial Guinea to Namibia. Capacity is growing in the continent at about 5% per year, according to the International Hydropower Association, under the premise that hydropower would provide African countries with greenhouse gas-free energy. The government of India is making the same calculations. In order to reduce the energy access gap for 40% of the nation's citizens, it has committed to quadrupling the amount of additional energy produced per year. Like Africa, India has untapped potential at about 23%, and so the government is gearing up for a 40% hydropower component in its energy production mix, and a rapidly expanding energy production at that. As more and more hydropower facilities are planned and funded, now is absolutely the time to be considering these questions of greenhouse gas emissions and how to account and mitigate for them. Should the emissions prove too high, it might be time to consider alternatives, even within the hydropower sector.
And you can do hydropower without reservoirs. You can do run of the river, and which will have less greenhouse gas emissions. And there are potentially ways to mitigate your emissions from a hydropower facility. The issue is just accounting for these greenhouse gas emissions, which isn't currently done. But if you account for them appropriately and with metrics that convey impacts over time and compare that to all your options out there and all of the other issues that play beyond just climate, then you can make an informed decision. and maybe hydropower wins out, even if it emits greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But the point here is that right now we are not making informed decisions because we are not including this in part of our accounting and assessment of the options that we have available to us.
We will come back to some of these ideas later. Elissa mentioned run-of-the-river hydropower, which will make a lot more sense when we come back to the question of alternatives. The key takeaway here, though, is that these calculations are not so easy to make. Hydropower is certainly renewable energy, but it isn't cost-free, and often not clean either.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay up to date with all the latest news from us, you can follow us on Twitter at BHRRC or search for Business and Human Rights Resource Centre on LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe to This Way Up wherever you get your podcasts. Keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share with your networks.